Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh, yes. Do you want to change? That's the first question I always ask people. And then I ask, do you know how to change? And tonight we're going to be featuring a man who's going to be talking about feelings, although I do have a caller on the line, and she wants to talk about, what do you do when you can't stop a behavior that you know is unhealthy for your relationship? So, Zoe, welcome to the Carol the Coach show. Tell me a little bit about your issue.
Hi, Carol. I until very recently was having an affair with my married boss. I started the affair when I was still married last summer and continued that through for several months, and he was my boss. He was in, I saw him all the time. We talked on the phone all the time. But during this, I was also in a relationship with another man that I really fell in love with. I think really like wanted to be with him for real and wanted to stop this other, the other relationship with my boss that was just a lot of sex. And I didn't really know how to do that because he was always in my space. And I had a really hard time telling him no and really hard time not. So I guess playing into what we had, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let me see if I got it straight, though. You were having a relationship with your boss, and then you met somebody else, and you really liked him, so you were in two relationships at the same time. And Zoe, you had sent me an email, so I know that you had said that you have never been faithful to just one person. So this is a pattern, right?
Yes, it definitely is a pattern.
And the other thing is that you thought that you were a love addict, and then your therapist suggested that maybe you were a female sex addict, correct?
That's right, and that's kind of how I discovered that love addiction was even a thing that existed. I had no idea. I'd heard of sex addiction, and then looked through like a it was like a table just in my Googling, and one of the tables said, you know, sex addict, codependent, and then one was a love addict. And I looked through the list of behaviors and was just kind of, my jaw dropped, and I was like, wow, like this is exactly me. This is what I do. I make up this big elaborate, you know, theme of what I think this guy's a perfect guy, and then I try to like mold myself to be just like him, and then, you know, after a while it's like I realize that no, that's not what I want, and then I just kind of distance myself, and that's when the cheating starts.
Well, and certainly what the audience doesn't know about you, but you indicated in your email that you have a very good profession. You're very honorable. You work with kids. You try very hard to do the right thing. And yet, you suggested that maybe your childhood played into this to some degree, because you may not call it trauma, but I believe what you went through as a child was traumatic. So would you share just a little bit about your parents and their relationship? Because that's obviously who you needed to model for love.
Yeah. So my parents divorced just before I was three. They had a very interesting custody relationship. Well, my mom was very unfaithful to my dad, had multiple partners. He actually hired a private investigator to find out, and then, you know, he was in a mental health hospital for a while. But the custody arrangement was 2 weeks with my mom and 2 weeks with my dad, and that started when I was three and went on until I was about 15 years old. And my mom was very, you know, party on the weekends, have a great time, you know, like, go get me a beer out of the refrigerator, you know, you can drink when you're 14 years old. And my dad was very, no, we go to church on Sunday, everything is exactly, you know, very, like, ex-Air Force precision. So it was very quite different environment.
Boy, you really learned early how to live that dual life, you know, one where everything's laissez-faire, you can drink when you're 14, you can take care of yourself, there are no rules. And then that other life, which is Southern Baptist, and you do what your dad says, or it's the highway, and it's my way or the highway. And so early on, you got groomed to feel comfortable living two different lifestyles, which is showing up right now in your own life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I ever really learned how, even now I'm still trying to learn how to live within one life, you know, one truth. That's what I'm starting to read some more books and do a little bit more self-discovery, because I always thought that my brain kind of made me really flexible, you know, and really open-minded, and I always kind of saw the positive in it. Just very recently with my divorce and just realizing that I had two relationships going on, and I was, you know, old enough to know better, but didn't really know how to control it, that I started seeing, like, well, maybe my childhood had something to do with this.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, when we're looking at somebody who has never been able to be faithful, it's almost as if they need the drama and the excitement of somebody else in their life just to keep them from feeling stable and settled and centered. You know, we also look for trauma or things in your life that actually were very difficult for you to handle. And you were honest enough to say that although there was some speculation of was it molest or not molest, that you had experienced sexually inappropriate things happening to you, which you said you hesitated to call molestation, but it was with a stepbrother who was six when you were four. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, it was kind of, it went on for a little while, and I don't know, I've started getting a little bit more memories of that as of lately, but yeah, it was very confusing. It was very confusing even now, because it was, to be perfectly honest with you, it was like enjoyable but not enjoyable, but it was like hard to, like, I knew it wasn't supposed to be enjoyable, but like it was like almost like a physiological thing, and I feel like I've carried around a lot of guilt about that for really, like, ever, you know?
Well,
I don't want you to feel guilt,
because clearly those kinds of experiences can be, again, that dual enjoyable and not enjoyable, where you feel good and you feel bad. It feels right, but it feels wrong. And, you know, a lot of times, how you can work through that is by the reactions of your parents. And your mom and dad had very, very different reactions to this, didn't they?
Yeah. Actually, you know, because the custody was split, I told my mom and my grandmother, and they actually went through the whole, like, you know, Department of Family and Children's Services route and filed charges against my dad to get custody of me because he had the full, like, legal custody, even though it was split. My mom wanted, you know, physical custody total. And he still tells me, like, even to this day will maintain that, like, she made a mountain out of a molehill. He says that. And he says that the judge said that whenever she brought him to court for it. I believe my mom is she can be very vindictive. She can be very, you know, the one trying to, like, eat at the wounds a little bit, you know. And my dad is I see him as very reasonable. So, like, that was kind of what I believed, you know. Like, I mean, he said that it was nothing, and she would just made a huge deal out of nothing, and that's kind of what I've, I guess, accepted.
Yeah, that had to be very, very confusing, especially because typically it's your mom that's very laissez-faire, and it's your dad that's very right or wrong. And this would take hours to dissect, to decide, was it molestation, was it sex play? But the important part is that whatever happened to you got used for the parents to fight against each other. And that always brings up a multitude of bad feelings. And so it is no wonder that having a real relationship and committing yourself to somebody is very, very difficult. So one of the things that I want to ask is, have you been to an SA or an SAA meeting to determine if that feels more comfortable for you or whether it is the SLAA meetings that speak to you?
No, ma'am, I haven't. There's, like I mentioned to you in the email that there's not really around here, but you said I could go via phone, and I, to be honest, I have not looked into that yet.
Well, and I really would love for you to do that. Here's what I want you to do, because you were so courageous to call tonight. I want you to check out some of those what we call telephone meetings. And again, you can Google SLAA telephone meetings, or I'm sure I see where you live, and there are some SA or SAA meetings in your area, are there not?
Okay, I can look again. Maybe I missed them the first time. I will look again.
If there aren't, then go ahead and look for the telephone meetings there, too, because, again, that doesn't have to be in your area. They obviously are all across the globe. I'd like for you to look at that. Now, what are you currently reading?
I'm reading The Intimacy Factor by P.M. Melody. I know you mentioned to get Love Addiction, but I actually, before you said that, I had started The Intimacy Factor, and so I've been reading that lately. And that really does speak to me about, it's like what a child needs, and like
yeah.
I really am able to like see the things that I didn't get, and I don't know. It's kind of crazy. I'm reading this, and these images that I'm not conjuring are just kind of popping in my head of me me this age taking care of me at that age. You know, like literally a physical, you know, Zoe at this age taking care of a little Zoe, you know, at 3 and 4.
That is
just
perfect,
incredibly
Zoe. Yes, absolutely. That is perfect, because that is definitely one of the very first things you can do for self-care, is to kind of protect that little kid and connect them both. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to attend a couple of those meetings. I want us through email to figure out a time when we can talk again. Maybe even devote a half a show to your situation where you can get some actual tips, and you can then kind of go back to your therapist and say, hey, this is what this therapist recommended. What do you think? And he or she can help you to formulate your treatment program based on what you believe is the real issue in your life. But I guarantee you, this duality that you learned so early in your life is contributing to the sex or love addiction that you have right now. And I can tell from your email, I can tell from us talking, that you really want something more meaningful in your life so that you can be the most authentic and transparent person possible.
I do. I'm trying really hard. Yeah.
Okay, you go to some meetings, whether they're virtual or real, and then would you get back with me, and then let's talk further.
Yes, I'd love to. Thank you so much, Carol. I really appreciate it.
Well, and I appreciate you calling in and listening to the podcast. You have a great night.
You too. Thank you, Carol. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. So as you can see, you can always call in at 646-595-3284. I'm more than happy to talk with you. That's what this show is all about. We're helping people with their feelings, with sex addiction, with love addiction, and all the different nuances that go into that. And I'm here for you, and I'm your only radio psychotherapist that deals with sexual addictions through iTunes. Sometimes we cover the basics, which is what we're going to be covering tonight. We have someone who is an expert at talking about feelings and stress. And what I know to be true about sexual addiction is if you have sexual addiction, it really is difficult to identify what your feelings are. So tonight we're going to be talking with Ken Howard, who's the founder of Aspen Partnership in Kansas City, Missouri. And he has been working with families and couples and individuals on their issues surrounding sex addiction, love addiction, and really helping them to live that authentic life by helping them to identify what are their feelings. And you know, if you've listened to me throughout the show, I say there are five primary feelings, and they're anger, sadness, loneliness, fear, and happiness. If you talk to the treatment center, she'll oftentimes find that they add shame and guilt because that accompanies sexual addiction. So I want to welcome Ken to the show. Ken, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, thanks for helping our listening audience, because it sounds so simple, and yet truly feeling identification and coming to grips with what's going on in the body can be very, very difficult. And so you have some book recommendations, you have some formulas, and I just have some questions for you, if you don't mind if I just...
Sure.
What made you decide that feeling identification was so important?
Well, it all began when, in my second year of my master's program, I realized how emotionally disconnected I was. And it was in our emotion, attachment, and trauma class, when I first started studying attachment, that I realized, wait a second, I have a problem here. I am not connected to my own emotional state. And this is 3 years into a marriage, 2 years into a master's program. I'm 8 months from being a therapist, and I realized, oh, no, I have anger and happy, and that's what I feel competent with. So once I recognized my own deficit, I really threw myself into studying emotion. I read Daniel Goleman's Emotional Intelligence, Social Intelligence, threw myself into Dan Siegel's work, really to turn inward into the intrapsychic, my own emotional strata, and to learn to connect deeply with myself. Because what I realized is, if I can't connect deeply with me, I can't connect deeply with others. And that had left me very vulnerable in my past for my own addictions, where I needed comfort, but I didn't know how to turn to people for that, so I turned to other stuff for that. So I had really set myself on a path to learn emotional competency. My wife deserved better. I deserved better. And I really wanted my children, who weren't even in existence yet, but I hoped that they would be, to have better of a parent than somebody with a flattened emotional state. So once I began to do that work for myself.
Well, that makes total sense. It's kind of like you knew what you needed, and, you know, that old saying about when we need something special, the teacher kind of shows up. So you decided, I'm gonna be able to figure out what it is I need, and then I'm gonna teach this to other people. So
absolutely.
That totally makes sense. Now tell me, most people think some feelings besides happy or glad are bad. You know, for instance, anger is a tough feeling for a lot of people. They don't like conflict. They don't like feeling anger. Do you believe that anger is bad?
You know, I don't. And, you know, I happen to look through a Christian lens, and in Scripture it says, be angry, but sin not. So So anger isn't the problem. It's the expression of it, the inappropriate expression of it. Aristotle had a quote that said, anybody can become angry. That's easy. But to become angry with the right person and to the right degree and at the right time and for the right purpose and in the right way, that's not within everyone's power, and that's not easy. So when people are hurt, but they express anger, that's inappropriate. When they're sad, but they load it into the shotgun of anger and blast their spouse's face off, well, that's inappropriate. And the problem is that if they're hurt, they're choosing a strategy then that ensures they're not going to get their needs met because people are going to back away from them, not move towards their anger. So that's the great sadness that I watch with many of my clients is they choose strategies that don't get their needs met. They're deeply wounded people, but they look on the outside like they are really angry.
Okay, so when you're looking really, really angry, it's important to decide, am I really, really wounded?
Yeah, because my experience is most of the time, you know, if you look at anger as a primary emotion, it's when there's been a boundary violation. That's appropriate. If somebody encroaches across a healthy boundary, then anger is a natural response because anger backs people up. And so now they back across that healthy boundary, and now you drop anger, and the next emotion comes up. But if I'm really hurt and I show anger, well, that's called a secondary reactive emotion, and those are very instrumental. And the problem is I'm not really showing you what I really feel. So either I'm not connected to my own sense of hurt, or I don't feel safe in holding it out. But either way, I'm not going to get my needs met. So that's the problem, is that with so many of my clients is they continue to choose strategies that don't get their needs met, and then they blame their partner for not getting their needs met.
Well, that is so true. And although I really feel like anger channeled properly is a motivator to do something that maybe you've needed to do, whether that's assert yourself or set
mm-hmm.
boundaries or clarify.
Yep.
You know, it really is by far one of the more motivating feelings if you use it in a healthy way and manage it.
Absolutely.
So I tell couples, you know, in healthy relationships, conflict breeds intimacy. When you're mad at somebody and you share that anger, if you're in a healthy relationship, you both talk about it, you work it out, and you end up feeling closer.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
a lot of our clients aren't in healthy relationships, so it can really backfire or it can feel unsafe to express it. So what do you teach your clients as to how to manage their anger?
Sure. You know, you said something that I think is genius, and it's the differentiation between what is conflict, where the end goal is intimacy, and combat, where the end goal is to win. Now, most people, when they say, well, I don't like conflict, what they're really saying is, I don't like combat because it's inherently damaging. I mean, I was 11 years as a combat medic. I played every sport known to man. I went to college on a debate scholarship. It makes no sense to me to step on a field of battle where my end goal is not to win. But if I take all of that firepower and I look through that lens at my wife, then as I'm trying to seek the hierarchical position of winner, well, there's only one other seat for her to take, and that's the position of loser. And now look what I've done to our intimacy. So I can win those battles, but I will lose the war for her heart. So what I teach folks is you've got to make a commitment that what you're wanting to establish in our process is intimacy in your marriage, which means you now have to choose the tools that are congruent with that end goal. So if you're deeply wounded, what are the tools to convey that message, but where you're working towards the end goal of intimacy? So that management of anger is peeling back typically the veneer of anger to what's the emotion that's really underneath there? Well, I'm deeply hurt. Okay, how do you express your deep hurt in a way that moves you towards intimacy with your wife?
That absolutely makes sense. Now, explain to me how that then can be useful. How is anger useful?
Well, like you said, it can be a wonderful fuel. And it can really compel you to say, hey, you know what? I don't like that. That's a boundary violation for me. Or that doesn't feel good to me. Or, you know, that's just, that violates my sense of self. And I'm not okay with that. And so that kind of righteous anger can well up and create very healthy boundaries and the firepower to now support that healthy boundary. So it can be a wonderful fuel that compels you into change or clarifying and reinforcing healthy boundaries. The place where that starts to get into the damaging is when anger now begins to be used in the combat, where now I'm trying to win, and the jagged barbed tools of war that I now use to express my anger, the purpose of them is to rip and rend and shred and crush. Well, those aren't healthy in a marriage. So it really is not, anger is not the problem. It's the expression of it, the use of it, that becomes the problem. If you're able to maintain that end goal, look, you hurt me, but you're not my enemy. Well, then I can maintain the clarity that says, then I need to set down the tools of war, combat, and pick up the tools of intimacy, which is doing conflict well, keeping in balance, using the right tools, which I've loved listening to you and how free you are with giving your clients and your listeners tools. That's really important for people to have conflict tools that move them towards intimacy.
Well, thank you. I really believe that, too, that if they have the tools and they have specific formulas, they're much mm-hmm. more likely to be able to remember them and to use them. As a matter of fact, you have something called the anger equation. Can you talk about
oh, yeah.
that? Because it's kind of like a formula in and of itself.
Yeah, you know, when I was a newly minted therapist, I was really unprepared for how much anger would be woven into the tapestry of almost everything I do in session. I mean, there's just, I would say 90%+ of my couples clients are couples, and probably 75% are couples recovering from affairs. And that causes some pretty high combustion in my office at times. And so I as I became a student of anger, you know, I probably read 25 books on anger just so I could get a sense of what's happening here and how do I contain it and manage it and is it useful and if so, how. And there was a book called When Anger Hurts, and the lead author on that is McKay. They're in their second edition, which is the one I would recommend. And they have this wonderful mathematics that they use, which is simply anger equals stress plus trigger thoughts. And there are three types of trigger thoughts that they list, one being negative intent. In other words, you did that on purpose. You're trying to hurt me. You're trying to disrespect me. So the immediate thought is you are doing something on purpose to hurt me. The second trigger thought is magnification. It's where you take a seemingly small, innocuous thing and blow it way out of proportion, and then you operate from that place. And then the third trigger thought is labeling. Because as soon as you put a label on somebody, you can no longer see them clearly. And you've now defined your dance. This is who you are, and this is how I relate to people who hold that title. So I love the elegance of the mathematics of this, because in that equation, anger equals stress plus trigger thoughts, my anger is not attached then to anything out there. It's completely, how am I metabolizing the stress throughout the day? So if you think about stress like the tinder and trigger thoughts like a match, and it needs both of them to come together to combust into anger. So if I'm managing my stress life, then there's very little tinder for to be combustible. And if I'm connected to my thought life, then when my daughter is watching the TV and trailing a line of milk from the table to the kitchen because she's not paying attention, if that trigger thought of, you're doing that on purpose, comes to my mind, and I can capture that and say, you know what, that's not true. She's three, and she's just not paying attention. She's not purposefully spilling milk on the floor. Then I can kind of blow out that match. So I love the elegance of that equation, because then anger really is about, am I managing the things I'm supposed to manage, not what's happening out there.
So that's exactly right. And I was going to ask you about giving us an example. So obviously talking about your daughter spilling the milk, having it not be intentional, is a great example. Now, if you would, let's take a client who possibly suffers from sexual addiction, has had infidelity in his or her life. How might anger equal stress plus trigger thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I mean, gosh, as you and your listeners well know, there is very few things as stressful as the nuclear blast of an affair or sexual acting out in a marriage or relationship. I mean, the ground is heaving underneath you. Everything you thought you know to be true now may not be true. There's just a tremendous amount of stress that is happening in that time. You know, oftentimes people go into hypervigilance where they're now expending hours upon hours going through phone records and bank records and, you know, becoming a private detective, all of which is extremely stressful. So, you know, that is a normative, some of that is a very normative part of that process of I'm just trying to get some control in a seemingly uncontrollable situation. But it comes with a tremendous measure of stress. So the awareness of that I and I've heard you try to bring to people who are in such a stressful place is you must practice self-care. You must practice self-care. And to load in the things that will help you metabolize stress, to help you be healthy. And then the trigger thoughts, those are the things that you have to manage. And here's where things get real dicey, because if you're working on the relationship, if this is something that's viable and you're choosing to stay and do the work, then the only way to build trust or to rebuild trust is to risk. And as hopefully the partner who's had the sexual acting out or affair is doing their work, then the partner's work is, as my fear comes up, to offer fear as fear, not fear as anger. So I have to now manage my thought life and really parse out what is truthful and what is fear-based, what is a lie, and to do my own work. And so, it takes a lot of mental energy. And once again, the necessity to practice self-care. If any of that starts to get out of balance, if I'm not metabolizing my stress, if my thought life gets into that automatic negative thought looping, well, it's very easy to combust into anger then.
Well, absolutely, and I'm glad you brought fear up, because obviously when I say for myself and my counseling, I really try to help people to just identify the primary feelings, and fear is one of them. You say very clearly that so much of bad behavior is rooted in fear. Fear of being left, fear of being hurt, fear of not being enough, fear of failure, fear of success, and on and on. Now, how does fear affect the body, and what can people expect if they really pay attention to their body? What can they expect to feel?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I've been delighted by is the amount of neuroscience that has come out that's really easily digestible by the masses, and I would put myself in that. I mean, I'm not a super smart brain scientist. I'm just fascinated by this brain that I have and how it works, and so I read a lot about it. And, you know, when you start studying the different parts of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, so this is our thinking brain. This is the part that's in front. It's responsible for rational thought and empathy, impulse control. This is the part that kind of makes us a human species. And it's wrapped around a part of the brain called the paleocortex. Now, cortex is Latin for bark. So if you see a cross-section of the brain, it literally looks like bark wrapped around itself. And so the older part of the brain, the paleocortex, it really manages things like survival, deep emotional experiences like fear, threat, trauma. And so this deep part of the brain called the limbic system holds these two little almond-shaped organs called the amygdalas. And although they're small, they're really powerful. And they hold and store templates of anything that has hurt you or threatened you or scared you. And they're kind of our body's alarm system. So when something out here triggers your amygdalas, they do two things. One, they cause to be flooded in your body for very powerful neurotransmitters and hormones that immediately ramp up your body into battle mode. And it happens in a flash, in a picosecond. The other thing that they do is they have 25 nerve fibers going to the prefrontal cortex and one coming back. So very powerfully what they can do is hijack the thinking brain and shut it down. And that may not seem like a evolutionary strategy of like, wouldn't you want your thinking brain online when things are stressful? But if you think about being out in the woods and you're walking along the path and out from a rock pops a bear, our thinking brain, a very powerful processor, goes, oh, my gosh, a bear. Is that a brown bear or a black bear? Well, look at that. It's well over 8 feet tall. It must be a brown bear. And it's quantifying. And in the meantime, the bear's eating the leg. Whereas our amygdalas, they fire, shut down the thinking brain, and now they go to fight, flight, freeze. Which, once again, that's a wonderful evolutionary strategy if you're in the woods. But the problem is your amygdalas don't know the difference between a bear and your spouse. So when your spouse does something that also causes your amygdalas to not feel safe, they fire, shut down the thinking brain, and flood your body with these battle chemicals. So these chemicals will affect our bodies in different ways. Your ears may burn, your chest may tighten, your stomach may have that pit, like falling out sensation. My right hand will clench, my jaws will clench. So there's some very telltale, predictable signs of your body experiencing anger or fear if you'll pay attention to the signs. So when I know I'm having an amygdala response, nothing good is going to come out of my mouth. And so my wife and I have this very well choreographed dance that if I say, sweetheart, I need a break, then we about face, we go to separate parts of the house, and I now start to do the work to de-escalate, calm down, recalibrate, make sense of what just happened for me. Now, in short time, I can come back to her, reconnect. Hey, I'm really sorry I said that. What were you trying to tell me? And now we're back into the conversation. But that's because I've learned what my body is telling me about what's happening within my own brain.
All right, so then the million-dollar question is, are there any fears to fear, since you just talked about how fear can be very protective and has kept us alive generationally? Are there any fears that you believe we should fear?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I grew up in a bad part of Kansas City. You know, I know what happens at night in some of the bad parts of town. I would be scared to go back and walk those streets that I grew up on, because I know what happens there. So there are fears to fear. If you're driving 100 miles an hour on snow, you should be afraid of that, because really bad things may happen if you hit a patch of ice. So there are things for us to register as fear and go, okay, I need to really, really pay attention to that. The problem is that when we get stuck in those automatic negative thoughts, Dr. Daniel Amen wrote a book called Change Your Brain, Change Your Life, and he talks about those ants, automatic negative thoughts, and that when those ants develop colonies in your brain, ants like mind reading or fortune telling or personalizing or blame, guilt, all of these ants can develop these looping structures in our brain that cause us to get stuck in them, where my brain thinks there's something to be afraid of, but there really isn't. And that's where fear, that hypervigilance, can cause us to get stuck, when there's really not a fear to fear. Does that make sense?
Oh, that makes total stress. So now, said that makes total, I mean, it's so understandable. And so, again, this is more reason for us not to fear our feelings. They all have something to teach us. One of the exercises that I give my clients is to identify their primary feeling that they feel perhaps in the morning, the afternoon, and the evening. Because let's face it, we get on such a fast track and life gets so busy, it's easy to kind of stuff our feelings and not pay attention to them.
Absolutely.
What kind of exercises do you give to your clients to help them come to grips with their feelings?
Yeah, well, I tell them to check in with themselves when they're going to the bathroom. I mean, that's just, you know, you're not doing anything. You're sitting there for a few moments. And to just kind of get your fingers on the pulse of, okay, how am I doing? And that can be on the heels of a really ugly meeting or on the way to go shopping with three kids in a minivan. You know, it's just, those are just easy times to kind of remember. I'm sitting on a toilet. Let me just check in with myself. And one of the things that I have to, and surprisingly, really convince a lot of my clients, as you have just clearly articulated, is that emotions are not bad. Emotions are a wonderful GPS system. They will tell you where you are in relationship to what's in front of you. And if you'll come to trust emotions, that they're like waves. They will ebb and they will flow, but they don't stay. And that's what I experience. A lot of men reflect back to me is, I'm really afraid of sadness, or I'm really afraid of hurt, because I'm afraid that if I move towards it, I'm going to get stuck here and I'll never be able to get out. But that's just not how emotions work. I mean, you could think of the most horrific experience you've ever experienced and the best experience you've ever experienced. And with high probability, you and your listeners are not experiencing that right now. So here's one of the biggest emotions you've ever experienced. And it doesn't even stay. So when we learn to trust that I can turn to hurt, and like a very wise Buddhist saying, you know, is, oh, brother hurt, I see you're here to teach me today. What do you have to teach me about myself? As I sort of lean into hurt and wrap around it and learn from the emotion that is trying to present itself to me to teach me something. But if I reject it, if I push away from it, then I can't learn the lesson, and I'm probably doomed to repeat the thing that caused the hurt to begin with.
Well, I like that, because clearly that indicates that, again, our feelings are our teachers. So they do have something to teach us. And it kind of takes us out of that victim role, and it creates empowerment when you say, okay, what do I have to learn from this? How can I grow stronger?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And when that's the mindset of, okay, let's step back from this experience I just had. What is there to learn? What would I like to do again? Let's do more of that. What didn't work I would like to not do again? Well, let's do less of that. And if you could just continue to learn in that way, do a little more of what's working, do a little less of what's not, you'd be amazed at how much life happens from that.
Yeah, and you know, clearly, one of the things that I believe with feelings is that it's so important to be able to manage them and to not be afraid of them. It's kind of the same thing with stress. You know, we're only beginning to learn how stress can affect our hearts and our bodies. Tell me a little bit about how you believe stress affects stress hormones and, you know, what is cortisol, and what can our listeners do to manage stress and manage the effects of stress on their body?
Yeah. Well, you know, remember I had said that when your amygdala is fire, they cause four very powerful hormones to be dumped into the system. One of them is our body's main stress hormone, which is cortisol. And in short, acute bursts, cortisol is a wonderful hormone. I mean, it ramps us up. It gets us ready to do something intense. But it was never meant to be in a chronic state. So, you know, if you think about a zebra on the savanna, happily munching its grass, maybe it's got a cut on its leg, but its body's repairing and its body's digesting and she's ovulating and, you know, all the steady state stuff that a zebra would be doing on a happy sunny day. And then its ear cocks back and it hears the lion coming. So in 2 picoseconds, that zebra's body has to flip off all the sustaining switches and flip on all life survival switches. One of those switches is cortisol. And so in the next 3 minutes of terrified running, either it's dinner and it doesn't matter anymore, or it realizes, okay, I've outrun the lion, and he looks around and I'm safe. And once the zebra realizes I'm safe, then all of the survival switches get turned off and the sustaining switches get turned back on. Now, that's That's how that's supposed to work. We're not supposed to stay in a chronic state of stress. But look at this chronic state of stress that happens when couples are recovering from an affair or sexual acting out or addictions of some kind or a horrible soul-sucking job or, you know, fill in the blank where stress is chronic. The problem is multifold, but cortisol begins to ravage the body. It has an affinity for the hippocampus. It will shrink the hippocampus in a chronic state. Well, the hippocampus is the part of the brain that takes an experience and integrates it into new neuronal connections. So that's what allows us to have short-term and then ultimately long-term memory. Well, if your hippocampus is shrinking and cortisol is interrupting the chemical messaging, then you can't remember stuff. And if you've ever been in a chronic state of stress of, hey, where's my keys? Has anybody seen my purse? Then that's cortisol at work. But in that terrified 3 minutes of running, one of the things that cortisol is doing is it's pulling a bunch of glucagon, which is glucose, blood sugar, out of the liver. So now you have a flooded state of high blood sugar. Well, that's great if it's 3 minutes, but if it's chronic, hello, diabetes. It's also pulling out blood or fat from the fat deposits because it's a wonderful long-burning sugar. Well, that's great if it's 3 minutes, but if it's chronic, hello, arteriosclerosis and heart disease. And, you know, I could go system by system. One of the main things is, as it shuts down the GI tract, 80% of our immune system comes from our GI tract. So if our GI tract gets shut down, our immune system is terribly compromised. So, I mean, and I could go system by system through the entire body, but that's what cortisol does. One of the things that's really important to understand about stress is that stress is really not about events and experiences nearly so much as it is about a person's perception of a circumstance. So what one person may consider very stressful, another may not consider stressful at all, like roller coasters. Are you a roller coaster fan, Carol?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I
love risk. And, you know, I was just sitting here thinking about how stress affects many of our listeners who are either sex addicts or partners
uh-huh.
of sex addicts.
Oh,
because
my gosh.
Clearly they are in that heightened state of stress, which obviously does affect cortisol levels. You said
yep.
nobody should be in that state long term. And
nope.
so although I love my roller coasters and I love doing things that are adventuresome and exciting, I don't like staying in that state. I like the relief
nope.
of feeling peace and serenity, too.
Yep, you pull into the station and that 1 minute ride is over, right? But imagine if that
mm-hmm.
went on for 4 months. You know, that would be a really ugly ride. And, you know, that stress, what some of your listeners may hate roller coasters. And if you and one of those listeners was sitting next to each other on the roller coaster, you would be feeling the exact same physiological stress, but the way that you perceived that would be very, very different for the two of you. So that difference is in whether the event is stressful or not lies in how you perceive it. So what you believe to be the importance of the event, the potential consequences of the event, and the amount of effort associated with the event. So those things add up to you now quantifying, is this situation stressful? And a sex addict who's out cruising for 8 hours a night, not getting sleep, for the partner who is constantly hypervigilantly managing, checking on the phone, where are they, finding them, you know, trying to catch them in their lives, all of that is terribly stressful. And so what you believe, what you perceive determines how much stress you have, and the amount of stress determines how tired you feel at the end of the day. So typically, people in an addiction or coupled with somebody in addiction, they're exhausted.
Absolutely. And again, that just plays havoc on the brain, the heart, and actually the soul. So now...
Yes.
I talked about some good books, and Deadly Emotions by Dr. Don Colbert is an excellent
yes.
book to deal with stress. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he's a doc that just had seen so much of how stress had impacted people's whole systems, you know, and it just, it became a passion of his to try to figure out how can we kind of get to the root of some of the symptomatic issues that we're dealing with, whether it's, you know, cardiovascular or GI tract or immune pain and inflammation, fibromyalgia, all that stuff that, in his estimation, he could go system by system and pull right back to the stressors that are in their life. And so he wrote this just for us to be aware of and then to be able to be very mindful of what can we do differently to de-escalate, to self-soothe, to self-care, and to try to work off these chemicals. So once again, when your amygdala fires, it's in anticipation of doing something life-saving, typically something very physical, running, fighting, etc. So when you have an amygdala response, when you are feeling very stressed, the worst thing that you can do is sit, because your body is now primed to do something physical. It's like standing on the accelerator of your car and the brakes at the same time. The amount of stress that that would cause your vehicle would be terrible. But that's what happens when our system is flooded with these battle chemicals, and then we're sitting in a cube in our office because we just came from a really toxic meeting. Or, you know, we're stuck in the minivan with four kids and about ready to lose our minds. So if there is at all possible the capacity to do something physical, it will better help metabolize these battle chemicals.
You know, you had referenced earlier self-care, and I had meant to ask you, especially because we're winding up and we haven't even talked about shame or trust yet, but what do you believe is helpful for people when they are working on increasing their self-care? I mean, obviously,
yeah,
exercise is one thing that really helps to burn off that adrenaline and work through it. What other forms of self-care do you recommend to your clients?
Sure. And, you know, there's a Dr. Ilardi who wrote, I believe it's called The Depression Cure. He has a clinic in Lawrence, Kansas, not too far from us. And one of the things that he absolutely makes his clients do before he'll even ever consider putting them on medication, unless, of course, they're suicidal, and, of course, that it happens immediately, is he has them do these six things. And I think it's in the high 80% that his clients never go on to needing medication. So he increases to 1,000 IUs a day of omega-3s, 1,000 IUs of vitamin D, to increase social support, so like reaching out to people, connecting to friends, increasing volunteering, choosing something to raise your head and stop navel-gazing in your anxious and depressed state and to realize, oh, there's other people out here hurting and I can make a difference, to get the appropriate amount of sleep, and aerobic activity, which is actually hands down by far the most effective thing that we have against depression, and it's something that our own body does. It makes opioids that really help us with a sense of well-being, endorphins and enkephalins, that when we do a really good aerobic exercise, that it increases that sense of well-being. Yoga, any mindful practice, whether that's meditation or in some instances yoga, can help flex that muscle of holding in focal attention the reality that's in front of you and not allowing those automatic negative thoughts to loop. Anything that begins a sensual, not sexual, but sensual experience, candles. For me, when I hold a cup of warm coffee, that's self-care for me. I love the smell of it. I love the warmth of it. It's soothing to me. Planting something is soothing. It's part of my mental health care. And so really, as people kind of turn inward to say, what brings me life? What delights me? Do that. And that's, unfortunately, when many people find themselves in a really stressful, ugly state, it's those life-giving things that are the first on the chopping block. They stop eating well. They stop exercising. They stop reading for pleasure. They stop connecting with people they care about. And they just gut all the things that bring them life.
you just came up with about 10 wonderful ways to take better care of yourself. Now, you've got to promise me, Ken Howard, that we will get back together on the show and we'll go over the rest of the information that you wanted to share, because this is important life skills, it's important theory, and it can apply to anybody, whether you're a partner, whether you love somebody who is a sex addict or not their partner, and of course the sex addict, him or herself. So I want to remind people that I'm talking with Ken Howard, and he is the founder of Aspen Partnership in Kansas City, Missouri. And so, Ken, people can get a hold of you by either going to your website, www.aspen-kc.com, or they can actually reach you through Ken at aspen-kc.com.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate everything you've contributed tonight to the show, and you've got to email me and pick a time in March or April, and let's wrap this thing up.
I'm all yours. I'm so glad that I could be helpful to you and your listeners. And, you know, the thing I would encourage all of your listeners with is, you know, if you're in a hard place, if you're in a bad place, as Churchill said, if you're in hell, keep going. Don't get stuck there. You can work yourself out of this. It is doable. There's resources like Carol out there. Use them.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you very much. And head over to his website. Again, that's www.aspen-kc.com. And have a wonderful night, and we will talk again soon.
Thank you.
All right. So as you can see, that man is filled with information and obviously really understands how important the feelings are, as well as managing not only stress, shame and fear and anger. So when we catch up with him next time, we'll be talking about trust and how do you build that up. That's a tough one, whether you're a partner of an addict or whether you're an addict wanting to trust yourself, and shame. And hopefully we can talk again to Zoe, who had the courage to call in tonight. So that's the end of this show. As I always, you know, there will only be one of you at all times, so I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself. And I look forward to talking with you next week. Same time, same place, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Blog Talk Radio.com, Sex Help with Carol the Coach.